The final investigator I met with was Dr. Dan Petrylak, and he began by discussing a fascinating clinical research concept, the use of novel biologic agents to prolong the time to progression in men receiving intermittent androgen deprivation.
The design of the study was basically Doug Figg and Bill Dayhood are the ones who were the principal investigators on this. And what they did was, the question was whether we could do intermittent hormone therapy and then delay the time to starting or restarting androgen blockade with the use of thalidomide. So all patients received an induction of 6 months of hormone therapy. Then they were randomized to either thalidomide or placebo. They were then monitored till progression, and if they progressed, they came off their treatment, they received another 6 months of induction, and then they received either thalidomide or placebo, but in the opposite fashion. So if they got thalidomide first, they got placebo afterwards, and if they got placebo first, they got thalidomide in the second situation.
Now, these are men with PSA-only disease.
These were PSA-only disease, rising PSAs after local therapy, basically.
And what was the criteria in terms, was there a doubling time criteria or something?
This was designed before the doubling time data was really known. So I'd have to look back at the exact numbers to tell you what percentage of patients had a rapid doubling time and who did not. But this was before doubling times were incorporated into any criteria.
I thought it was really an interesting way to do research. I don't know, has this been done a lot or even at all?
Well, this was one of the first trials to be evaluated in this way. And I think it actually can be very, very timely, considering the fact that we've had two randomized studies in Europe looking at intermittent hormone blockade in men with hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, showing very similar survivals to continuous combined blockade with perhaps an improvement in quality of life. The study that will truly answer that question is the SWOG study, where patients are being randomized to continuous androgen blockade versus intermittent therapy, and it's a much, much larger trial. And that, I think, will give us the definitive answers to whether intermittent therapy is as good as, better than, or equivalent to continuous combined blockade.
Now, I know that a lot of these different intermittent, not everybody has exactly the same way they do it. So in your study, which I thought was really interesting, you know, you have this intermittent hormone therapy backbone, and then on top of that, you're trying to lay in the question of the thalidomide. What was the backbone in terms of, you know, how far back would the PSA have to come back in order to be considered progressing, for example?
It was either a PSA of 5 or if they went back to their baseline PSA.
Right. And that seems like kind of a typical approach.
Yeah. It's a very typical approach for these patients.
And can you talk a little bit about thalidomide in terms of what it is? And I was kind of surprised when I saw it popped up in prostate cancer. Of course, we're seeing it a lot with hematologic malignancies.
Right. So the IMiDs are a class of compounds that have really two distinct mechanisms of action. The first mechanism is anti-angiogenesis. It will bind VEGF. It will also bind to the pericytes. It has clearly an anti-angiogenesis mechanism. And the interesting way this all came about was that Judah Folkman, a number of years ago, asked one of his postdocs to find him an agent that had anti-angiogenic activity so they could evaluate this in the laboratory. And he said, think about the data back to thalidomide in the 1950s, where the limb development in fetuses was retarded, and you had these children who were born without proper limbs, either their upper or lower body. So that's where the idea came from.
And I guess for the people who may not know, the late Judah Folkman was considered, I guess, the father of angiogenesis.
Yes, and he really championed that approach when a lot of people didn't believe that it was going to work. And to his credit, there's been a whole field that's developed from that. So thalidomide was originally designed as a sedative. It has anti-angiogenic activity. It also has T-cell stimulatory activity as well. And this is where the interesting play comes in with the IMiDs.
And I guess IMiD is thought to be an immune agent.
Correct. So lenalidomide or Revlimid is a second generation IMiD. It's approved by the FDA for myelodysplastic syndrome as well as for multiple myeloma. And the thought is that there may be a little bit less anti-angiogenic activity with Revlimid, but perhaps there's more immune modulatory activity with Revlimid.
And we should say, I mean, it really has had a huge effect on myeloma.
Exactly.
Major.
So it's a very, very promising agent. There are ongoing studies in prostate cancer right now. We have one at Columbia that looks very, very promising. We presented the first set of data at ASCO Prostate in 2007, and we found that in patients who had failed docetaxel, and when we put them on this phase 1 docetaxel Revlimid study, we had responses. And this is now prompting a registration trial, which I believe will open later this year, comparing docetaxel plus Revlimid to docetaxel.
What about Revlimid by itself?
There is some data. It has not been published yet, as far as I know, but there are individuals who are looking at Revlimid as a single agent in castrate-resistant disease.
So if you can talk about what this study showed, and also I was fascinated by the correlative study looking at androgen levels and the whole endocrinology thing.
Right. So the endocrinology thing is interesting from the standpoint that it has broader applications to the overall population of patients. So when we think about doing combined androgen blockade plus radiation therapy, and we start looking at different studies, and we think about being on a defined period of hormone therapy for 2 years, let's say, or 3 years. So the effects of the hormone therapies may actually last a longer period of time than we originally thought. And that's been something that's been known. But what this study found, as far as the recovery goes of the testosterone, if you had a higher baseline level of testosterone, you had a better chance of recovering your testosterone to a normal level. If you had a lower baseline level of testosterone, it took longer and you had less of a chance of recovering.
What about age?
The older patients generally had lower levels of testosterone, so they tended to do a little bit worse.
But I guess one of the things, too, you were looking at is not just sort of what happens in the base situation, but whether or not the thalidomide had any effect on that.
Correct. And it did seem to delay progression in those patients.
So it delayed progression, but did it affect the endocrinology?
I don't think it did, if I remember correctly.
No, it did. That was the interesting thing. It seemed like it wasn't affecting the blood levels, et cetera.
No, it doesn't affect the blood levels. The interesting thing, if you look at hormones, everybody thinks about one mechanism of a drug. So Ralph Budde and other investigators have looked at the changes in angiogenesis in relationship to androgen blockade. And you can actually see destruction of the capillary endothelium once a patient is blocked. And so hormone therapy, in addition to having a direct effect on the stroma, a direct effect on the prostate cancer cells, also has an effect on the blood vessels. And certainly the thoughts are to move some of these agents up earlier, and certainly makes sense that thalidomide would have a secondary effect or a different type of effect. So yes, although it's a little bit surprising, I'm not so surprised because it's a separate different mechanism.
I mean, it did seem, though, that the thalidomide did delay progression by a fairly significant amount.
It certainly did. It definitely delayed progression in the situation.
So where do you see this strategy moving forward, or is it going to move forward, this idea of intermittent androgen deprivation and trying to stretch it out?
Well, I certainly think that we used to believe that hormone therapy was benign. I mean, the only thing you really lost was your sexual function. Now we're seeing that there's an increased rate of osteoporosis. There's loss of muscle mass. In patients who are diabetic, it's more difficult to control their diabetes. Lipid levels are actually altered, higher levels of LDL, lower levels of HDL. In looking at risk of fatal myocardial infarction, higher risk of fatal myocardial infarctions in patients who undergo androgen blockade. So all of these particular factors would suggest that we need to be more prudent, more selective in those patients who undergo androgen blockade. And perhaps if intermittent therapy becomes a standard of care, we can then begin to use this to investigate agents that may delay the time that you're on hormone therapy. Maha Hussain has identified from her SWOG group, she's the PI on the intermittent trial, she's identified those patients who are poor risk. Those patients who don't achieve a PSA of 4 or lower, those are what you would call upfront hormone-resistant prostate cancer patients. They have survivals of about 11 months overall. These are patients who I think, once we get the full set of data, this is a good group to then look at agents in high-risk patients for prolonging survival. But now we also have another group of patients who are better risk, who potentially may benefit from quality of life standpoint by being off androgen blockade even longer. And if we can find an agent that will do so, whether that be a cytotoxic agent or whether it be an agent like thalidomide, I think that's a fertile area for investigation.
What's your take on the overall impact on quality of life of the strategy of intermittent androgen blockade, more kind of globally, not just acutely, but if you look over a 2, 3, 4 year period, do you think this is improving quality of life for most people, some people?
I think it improves quality of life. It really depends, of course, upon whether they regain testosterone or not. I mean, I think that that's certainly an issue. If you really wanted to be a purist, if you were a purist in the situation, what you would really do is give them a defined period on hormone therapy and then reinduce them with testosterone after that, because a lot of these patients will inconsistently cause their testosterone levels to go up. And if the theory behind endocrine therapy is the differentiation or providing prostate cancer cells the ability to differentiate along a pathway that is androgen sensitive, so by re-exposing them, when you withdraw it again, you're going to be able to induce apoptosis. Perhaps in that situation, getting back to a physiological level of testosterone more quickly would be something that would be desirable, something that needs to be investigated. But that would control whether you're seeing the testosterone effect or simply this other endocrine effect that we talked about before, that some patients never really will regain their testosterone levels.
Why don't we talk about a couple of your cases?
Sure.
Maybe start out with a 62-year-old man.
So this is a 62-year-old male with a history of difficulty urinating. He undergoes a biopsy of his prostate in March of 1995. His initial PSA was 38. His biopsy demonstrated Gleason's 9 adenocarcinoma. He underwent 5 months of neoadjuvant androgen blockade, and he underwent a radical prostatectomy. His final pathology demonstrated Gleason's 9 adenocarcinoma with seminal vesicle invasion, and his PSA after surgery was less than 0.1.
Were you following him at that point?
No, I actually saw this patient much, much later in his course.
Okay. What kind of work did he do?
He was actually an accountant.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what was the next point?
So he basically went on androgen blockade at that particular point.
Maybe it would be worth just taking a step back and saying what the options or thoughts might be
right
at that point. Because, I mean, just literally looking at that situation with that tumor, it'd be interesting, you know, to see how people in practice as well as investigators, what they would do. What would you have done with him if you'd been following him then?
So at that time, I probably would have just observed him at that point. You know, now with some of the more recent data from SWOG, one could consider giving adjuvant radiation therapy at this time to this type of patient.
Would you have done it? Would you do it now?
With the SWOG data, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you would have radiated him.
And I mean, he's a high-risk patient. And I would consider radiation on him.
And what about the hormone therapy?
Hormones, no. Again, I don't think continuing the hormone therapy would be appropriate. And of course, now we don't do neoadjuvant therapy for these patients. So I think that these are reasonable options. And he continued on androgen blockade. His PSA rose to 7 in January of 2000. CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis was negative for metastatic disease in the soft tissue.
2000? Oh, I missed that part. This is a while back then, huh?
Oh, yeah, this is a while back. Well, he had his prostatectomy in 95.
95, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And so that's why the neoadjuvant hormone therapy, because that was more in vogue at that particular
okay
point. But in January of 2000, he developed metastatic disease in the bone, and it was a super scan. So at that point, he had his Casodex stopped, and his PSA rose after his antiandrogen withdrawal, and he then started docetaxel and estramustine. He developed a DVT while on docetaxel and estramustine, and he was started on Lovenox and was subsequently switched to Coumadin. And he received 30 cycles of treatment overall. Did incredibly well with this.
Was he on the trial?
This is before he was referred to me. He was not on the study. And then he began to progress at that point. And his PSA began to rise from 5 to 15. So at that point, he was referred into me. And very nice man, very nice family. And so I offered him a clinical trial. And there are options in second line, of course. We don't have an FDA-approved agent. And this was before the satraplatin study was open. So I offered him a phase one study that we were performing at that particular point. And he went on this trial, which was gemcitabine with a drug called LY2311, which was supposed to make the gemcitabine more active. It was a PPAR gamma inhibitor. And pain became progressively worse. His PSA rose to 90, and he developed progressive disease in bone as well as retroperitoneal lymph nodes. So, again, we were at a decision point with this patient. Should we give him an isotope, which is actually something I think is very neglected in the management of castrate-resistant prostate cancer? And there's some good data out of Memorial from Mike Morris's group that you can safely combine samarium and other agents with docetaxel, offer the patient another clinical trial, or just simply palliate this patient, do nothing aggressively therapeutic. So we decided to give him samarium, and he got that in September of 2001. His pain got better, but his PSA then went up to 613. His hemoglobin was 7.8, and he was now requiring weekly blood transfusions. And we started him on weekly paclitaxel in December of 2002. And his PSA continued to rise, and he began to develop myelosuppression. Platelet count was 20,000, and his fibrinogen and fibrin split plaques were consistent with DIC. As PSA then rose to 1,010, and we checked his testosterone level, it was castrated less than 4. And I had a very, very good relationship with the family, and the wife and I went into my office and we sat and talked for a while, and she was not ready to send her husband to a hospice, and neither was he for that matter. And so I sat and I looked through the chart and I said, gee, you know, this man never went on a secondary hormone manipulation, never was on nizoral hydrocortisone. And so we went and put him on nizoral hydrocortisone, and his PSA declined from 1,010 to 15 very rapidly. August 2002, stopped all his pain medications. He did not require transfusion any further, at least at that particular point. And he had a good 7 or 8 month response to nizoral cortisone. Actually went down to Atlantic City and was able to play the tables again, and he was very, very happy. And this case, I think, illustrates this issue that we still don't understand how to sequence secondary hormone manipulations and chemotherapy, and when's the right time to pull the trigger on these patients. And I think that's particularly interesting from the standpoint that we have two agents that are out there right now, or two classes of drugs in clinical trials. One is much more advanced. This is the data with abiraterone. And then there's the medivation drug, which is about to go into a phase 3 study. And abiraterone works by inhibiting the 1720 lyase pathway, and this will really slam the door on testosterone production.
So is this blocking adrenal production of testosterone?
No. The interesting observation, you know, the old thing about rediscovering data. So Jack Geller is an endocrinologist. I'm not sure if he's an endocrinologist or urologist, but he's out in California. I actually met him a number of years ago. Great guy. He actually described the fact in the either late 1960s or early 1970s that the levels of testosterone in the tissue did not correlate with the levels in the serum. So castrate patients could have elevated levels of testosterone in tissue. And that observation was recently reconfirmed by Jim Moeller and his group in CALGB. So either the prostate tissue is concentrating the adrenal androgens and then converting them over to dihydroxytestosterone, or there's de novo synthesis. Either way, abiraterone will block that particular pathway.
Kind of reminds me of the aromatase inhibitor story in breast cancer. Right. I know the endocrinology is a little, or chemistry is a little bit different, but it's that same concept of intratumoral or intra-breast estrogen levels.
Right, exactly. And this is interesting from several factors. Number one, we do know that 90% of prostate cancer patients still have their androgen receptors intact. So either this is one mechanism in which the androgen receptor is activated by low levels of testosterone, or some of the newer drugs that we're looking at, anti-insulin-like growth factor antibodies, anything on the mTOR pathway, all of these can also phosphorylate the androgen receptor and activate them. So we have a really panoply of different ways that we can activate the androgen receptor in this particular situation. So this is still active. And the preliminary data that was published by De Bono's group showed, you know, responses with this particular approach. There are two randomized trials that are going on right now. One is in late stage disease after docetaxel, abiraterone versus placebo. There's a planned second study to be performed in pre-docetaxel patients, abiraterone versus placebo again.
Have you used the drug yourself?
I have not used the drug myself, but we are planning on doing a phase 1 study combining abiraterone with docetaxel. So I think that's going to be interesting from two different standpoints. Number one, of course, if the abiraterone gets approved, you have a very high-risk patient. You'd like to start them on maximal treatment to begin with. But Dave Nannis' group at Cornell has made a very interesting observation. So he's been looking at circulating tumor cells in men with a castrate-resistant prostate cancer who are on docetaxel treatment. Those who are sensitive, the androgen receptor is excluded from the nucleus. Those who are resistant to docetaxel, the androgen receptor is able to cross the nucleus and become active.
And that relates to docetaxel sensitivity?
Yes. I mean, if you think about this, you're affecting cytoplasmic microtubules, which are involved in trafficking within the cells. They're involved in cellular structure. You disrupt the structure, you may not be able to let the androgen receptor across the nucleus. If it's not disrupting the structure, the androgen receptor goes across and becomes active and is able to induce gene expression. So we're actually going to collaborate with Dave in looking at this in patients who are potentially docetaxel resistant, see in a large group of patients if this does hold.
That's fascinating. So any other follow-up on this patient?
Yes, well, he actually failed the Nizoral and cortisone after about 7 months, and he went on a phase one study of docetaxel and PS341, which, of course, is bortezomib. He didn't respond to treatment, and then he passed away in May of 2003. So he did fairly well with castrate-resistant disease. I mean, he actually was on a fair amount of docetaxel treatment. And again, I think the important thing about a patient such as this is that long-term survival is possible with chemotherapy in these patients.
Now, along the way, what kinds of problems, if any, did he have with the docetaxel?
He developed neuropathy, and so that, again, is one of the advantages of intermittent therapy. Patients can have improvement in their neuropathy to some degree.
What exactly happened? How bad was it? Where was it?
It was in his feet and his fingers.
Did it bother him a lot?
Towards the end of his first series of docetaxel treatments, he did have trouble signing letters and writing. Fatigue is also a problem with long-term docetaxel treatment. Some patients feel like they have a persistent case of the flu, and they're pretty debilitated from that. Tends to go on more with more treatment. But there are some patients who can tolerate a fair number of cycles, and the issue is how much is enough in these patients. And again, that's where the intermittent therapy comes into play and is important, because you can get, in a patient who's had a complete PSA response, you can have breaks of 4, 5, 6 months in these patients. And then 60 to 80% of these patients will respond again.
And that certainly is a strategy we've seen, for example, in colon cancer, not with the taxanes, but with chemotherapy, of intermittent therapy. Even lung cancer, you know, breast cancer is not exactly stop, start, stop, start, but they don't necessarily give it indefinitely.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely.
You obviously were right in the middle of the key research that was done that brought docetaxel actually right into patient care in terms of prostate cancer. Looking back now, since that introduction over the last few years, do you think that the drug has actually brought the benefit to patients that it potentially could be? In other words, is it actually being offered to patients, and are patients, do you think, in practice receiving it, or at least being offered it?
Well, I see a skewed group of patients, so that's a little bit different with me. But I know that I've seen statistics saying that about 60% of patients receive docetaxel at some point in their course of castrate-resistant disease. And that's been a fairly constant number since the approval of the drug in 2004. It would be interesting to see what the reasons are from that 40%. Why they didn't receive docetaxel. Is it refusal of the patient? Is it refusal of referral? Or just simply the patient is not medically fit enough to go on docetaxel-based therapy? You know, I've treated patients from all ranges of age with docetaxel. We've seen some good responses, and there's some patients who just simply progress right through it. And so clearly, I think a lot of these second-generation studies, the bevacizumab study, the VEGF-TRAP study, Dave Quinn's atrasentan study in SWOG, I think these are all crucial to determining whether we can actually improve the overall response rate of docetaxel and make it less toxic.
What about research and also patient care in terms of docetaxel in the earlier stage setting? Clearly, again, looking at other tumors, you know, breast cancer right now, docetaxel is very commonly utilized in the adjuvant setting. What are the trials that are out there looking at, I guess you'd say, adjuvant therapy as well as PSA-only disease?
So the two big adjuvant trials that we were banking on, the SWOG 9921 study, to refresh our memory, that was a trial that compared mitoxantrone and prednisone post-prostatectomy in high-risk patients. The mitoxantrone and prednisone was combined with hormones, and that was compared to hormones alone. And that trial closed because of 3 episodes of acute leukemia in the mitoxantrone arm.
And I guess we should say that's a big reason why you have seen the shift in breast cancer away from the anthracyclines, in this case, adriamycin, is both leukemia as well as heart failure. Not that common at all. Very, very uncommon, but still it happens.
Right. So whether this is going to skew the survival data or not, we don't know. And the trial was designed for 1,300 patients. It enrolled more than 1,000 patients. So certainly, we still may see something with this.
Any idea when?
I don't know. it's going to take, I think, a while for us to really see something from this. I'm just speculating, but I don't know when we'll see it. The other trial that was a disappointment was the ATLAS study. And this was a randomized trial, very similar group of patients to the SWOG study, randomized to either early or late therapy. And then the randomization after early versus late was hormones plus docetaxel versus hormones. That trial closed as well because of accrual issues. So those are the two adjuvant trials that we were hoping to see some benefit from.
When you say accrual issues, what actually happened?
The accrual was slow, and within the time frame of the trial, it was not felt to be able to show the necessary events to show a difference between the arms.
Do you think the accrual was slow because people didn't kind of like the randomization or other reasons?
I think it was because it wasn't publicized well enough. Dave Crawford, to his absolute credit, really promoted the SWOG 9921 study along with Mike Lede, who was the PI on that. And there were videos, there were other ways of getting patient information out there to let both urologists and oncologists know that this trial was open, and it was a paradigm shift. And there was a lot of hard work done to shift that paradigm. I don't think that that was done to the same degree with the ATLAS study. And it was an international trial, and perhaps it would just simply take more to catch on in that particular situation. But it's disappointing that that trial will not be completed. Well, we may get some information out of it. I don't recall the exact accrual number on it, but we may get something out of it. The trial that's open and ongoing is Jim Eastham's study in the CLGB, which randomizes patients to docetaxel chemotherapy prior to prostatectomy or immediate prostatectomy. And that's a neoadjuvant trial. And that trial is open and accruing patients. And it's for high-risk patients. So those are the prostatectomy studies that are of interest.
What about PSA-only disease and chemotherapy trials?
So PSA-only disease, there's a study that Mike Morris is the PI on, and this trial is taking patients with a rapid PSA doubling time. They're randomized to receive continuous combined hormone therapy for 2 years versus hormone therapy plus docetaxel chemotherapy, and the docetaxel chemotherapy is for 10 cycles overall. And that will help us determine whether the early chemotherapy will be useful in this particular situation. There's another study that's also looking at early chemotherapy. This is by the ECOG group, and that is taking metastatic patients, randomizing them to docetaxel plus hormones versus hormones. So those are interesting trials, but one thing I think is important to consider is the fact of sequencing. So, you know, the issues that have been seen in the laboratories, and this is from Arif Hussain's group in Maryland, that if you give docetaxel chemotherapy prior to giving hormones versus giving them concomitantly or giving the docetaxel hormone failure, that in his mouse systems, those mice tend to live longer with the sequence of docetaxel hormones. So we may see the same situation.
Again, just like breast cancer, if you think about it.
As in breast cancer, exactly, that the sequencing is important.
Because I guess in breast cancer, the thinking was that maybe hormonal therapy will interfere with the benefit of chemo by, I don't know, slowing tumor cells from dividing?
That's one thought of that, or that may be inducing apoptotic mechanisms.
Right.
I mean, there are a lot of different ways of looking at that. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we really have a lot of work to do still. And again, this is why all urologists, we really welcome your help in getting patients on these randomized trials.
So I've got to ask you about my favorite topic in any cancer, which is the issue of association of diet, exercise, and cancer progression. There's been stuff in breast cancer and colon cancer, and I know you were part of one effort that was coming out of SWOG looking at body mass index.
Right.
And is anything going on right now in general in terms of that in prostate cancer?
Well, there are some studies looking at nutritional supplements. You know, there's the pomegranate juice study that's been done.
What's that?
That's a randomized trial, rising PSA patients of pomegranate juice versus placebo.
Wow. How much pomegranate juice?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
Is there something, what's in pomegranate juice?
There are a number of antioxidants
really?
In pomegranate juice, and that's, you know, it's thought to delay progression. You know, if you take animals and you feed mice a low-fat diet and another group of mice a high-fat diet, and then look for progression of their prostate cancer when they've had cells induced, the ones that have the high-fat diet will die more quickly. So certainly it's seen in animals. I mean, I think that eating a heart-healthy diet is a prostate-healthy diet, and certainly that, from a general health standpoint, is a good thing. But certainly nutritional studies need to be performed in a randomized basis. They're hard to do.
You were mentioning before insulin growth factor, and that's one of the sort of intermediaries that's been discussed in terms of this whole thing. So, you know, to me, as I've been looking at this, it seems what's interesting is not trying to find a good diet for your patient to take, although maybe that's an issue too, but trying to find a substance or a pathway that in some way is getting affected that we could affect in another way. Why don't we talk about the other patient you're going to talk about today?
So this is a 72-year-old male who presented with a palpable mass on digital rectal exam. He had a PSA of 18 and a biopsy demonstrated Gleason 7 in 2 of 6 cores, 30% in one and 50% in the other. He opted for androgen blockade combined with radiation therapy. He had severe hot flashes and depression on treatment. And so the question was, how long should we continue with androgen blockade?
At what point was he starting to really get miserable?
He was starting to get miserable about a year into the course of the androgen blockade.
And were you taking care of him that whole year, or when did you see him?
I saw him actually as an initial consultation for the management of localized disease.
So you had been seeing him all along?
I had been seeing him all along, and I saw that there was a definite degradation in his quality of life as time went on.
What specifically was going on there?
Fatigue. You know, one of the comments that Willa Whitmore once made about androgen blockade and prostate cancer is that men feel as if the wind has been knocked out of their sails. And that was the big thing that he felt. He was a lawyer. He felt his mental function wasn't as good. He was struggling for a period of time on his androgen blockade.
So he made it out to a year, though?
He made it out to a year, and actually we sort of moved him along up to 3 years, and he actually got his full 3 years of treatment. So he made it out, and then he began to feel better. I recommend to a lot of my patients that they try to exercise as much as possible to overcome depression. You know, if you look at some of these randomized studies, there was one I remember years ago about a randomized trial of exercise versus antidepressants, and they turned out to be exactly the same. But he recovered, and then he received a total of 3 years of androgen blockade. His PSA nadir at 0.4, began to rise again. 6 months later, it was 6.4. His bone scan and CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis were negative at that point. And we talked at length as to what to do, and because he had such a bad reaction to androgen blockade, he decided to wait to be treated. And it rose to 15, 16 months later. At that point, he was metastatic. And so the question was at this time, what to do for this patient?
Getting back to that other point when he didn't want to take the hormones, what about single-agent antiandrogens?
Well, one of the problems with single-agent antiandrogens, such as bicalutamide in the dose of 150 milligrams, is the issue about high risks of cardiovascular problems. The Canadians originally approved that for prostate cancer, then pulled their approval back based upon some issues with arrhythmias. I think that one study that was really never followed up upon was the peripheral androgen blockade that the CLGB evaluated using Proscar plus flutamide or Proscar plus Casodex in this setting. The problem with that is they develop gynecomastia because your body will then upregulate testosterone levels to overcome the block. So although there may be salutary effects on the bone, certainly using this approach is not standard at this point and needs a randomized trial.
So what's his current situation?
So he went on, we decided after a period of time to go with a 6-month induction period of hormones. He went on intermittent therapy, and then after 3 cycles, his PSA did not normalize, so he stayed on treatment, and he eventually went on docetaxel-based therapy afterwards.
How did he do on that?
He had a response for about 6 months, and then he progressed and went on, they actually went on the satraplatin study. It was really a typical course of prostate cancer from hormone-sensitive localized disease to metastatic disease.